I wonder if really calling this a debate makes much sense. I'm not sure who's going to be taking the affirmative on the question of, is Donald Trump a stable genius? I'm not sure how many of you have had a chance to read Fire and Fury. It really is a remarkable book and quite a fun read. I think when you're reading it, you should of course take everything in it with a grain of salt. Michael Wolff is not the most reputable journalist, but it does seem like he was able to get virtually all the major figures in the Trump administration on the record saying absolutely remarkable things about the President of the United States. The portrait in it of a human being in the most powerful executive position in the world, lacking what psychologists call executive mental capacity, is really, I'd call it unbelievable if I didn't myself believe it. It's important not to exaggerate here. So there's been speculation about whether Donald Trump is functionally illiterate. I think the fact that he was able to get through an hour and 20-minute speech last night reading off a teleprompter is pretty good evidence that he's not. The man can read. But he lacks certain psychological capacities that often go under the description of impulse control, right? So that what he wants at any given moment is not part of a larger plan to achieve goals in a rational means and way. As a result, the last person he talks to is the person who understands how to stroke his ego, how to make him feel good about himself, is able to get their way. So the portrait Wolff paints is of a White House where at the time, and he covers more or less the first year of the Trump administration, but really ends with the departure of Steve Bannon, who was clearly his primary source. Wolff paints a portrait of a White House with three factions: Steve Bannon and the alt-right, the traditional Republican leadership represented for a time by Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, who was a close ally of Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, and then the Jarvanka, New York, Goldman Sachs kind of faction led by Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump and bringing in some Wall Street people. And Trump himself, you can't really call him, someone who has the ideology of neo-fascism or the alt-right, or someone who has the ideology of Wall Street, or someone who has traditional Republican views, because he really doesn't have any views at all. He's manipulated by these three factions. Now, of course, as a result of the book, which clearly was mostly based on what Steve Bannon had to say, the alt-right faction has been significantly weakened. Bannon himself is out. Steve Miller, who's Trump's main domestic policy advisor, is still semi-aligned with that faction, although he also has connections with Congress. He was a previous aide to Jeff Sessions when Jeff Sessions was in the Senate. So I guess the question is, it's an amazing read. The particular incidents of Trump in bed with his cheeseburgers railing against the TV news are incredible. But is it actually very important? And on one level, it's not. Paul Kelly, not Paul Kelly, John Kelly is now chief of staff. The mainstream Republican Party that controls Congress is clearly in control of the administration's agenda. The grown-ups are in charge, and they discount what Trump says most of the time. And of course, what's happening is exactly the sort of agenda you'd expect to see carried out if the Republican Party had centralized control of the US federal government, which they now do. And of course, we can criticize that agenda, but it's not neo-fascism, it's not utter chaos, it's what the Republicans have said they've wanted for a good decade now. On the other hand, though, even when the administration is basically functional, as it has been more or less since Kelly took control. The fact that the person officially in charge has this degree of mental incapacity and instability is surely momentous. And as a political philosopher, I think, you know, I always go back to Plato. And there's a story Plato tells in The Republic about how democracy turns into tyranny. That in a democracy, the central value is freedom. Everyone gets to do whatever they want. That's what we celebrate in a democracy. But of course, freedom depends on self-control. If you're free to do whatever you want and you're just pushed hither and yon by your wants and you completely lack impulse control, then your freedom will just become chaos in your personal life and in the life of the country as a whole. And as people's desires get more and more chaotic, as their impulse control fades, as their attention spans get shorter and shorter, as they look from one shiny object to the next shiny object, someone is going to say, I can buy you off by giving you what you want. See, here, look at this shiny thing over here. Here, look at this shiny thing over there. And they, of course, are this completely out of control psyche, which just has these endless, uncontrollable desires for more and more and more. And they're able to distract us because we lose our self-control, and they're able to become the tyrant. And that's a story Plato told thousands of years ago. And it's about the connection between politics and psychology, between the city and the soul, between the kind of regime we have and the kind of people we are. And I worry if, you know, Trump's genius isn't genius, but there is a sense in which when we're all distracted by our phones, when we're all increasingly looking for those short-term shots of cheeseburger pleasure and ego boosting from the likes on Facebook and what have you, that there's some sense in which Trump's tyrannical personality lines up perfectly with increasingly how all of our personalities in the highly distracted, highly democratized, highly free, but at the same time out of control 21st century is going. And I wonder if Fire and Fury isn't as much about the dangers of a kind of mental incapacity that we're all increasingly suffering from, of which Trump's genius is just to be the living embodiment, the avatar, the Twitter head of a moment which poses real political and psychological dangers to all of us.
Thank you, Michael. It's really interesting talking about Trump with sort of a variety of people. I suppose at UEA, we're quite left-leaning university, so you don't get much a range of opinion necessarily on Trump. But I suppose I want to start off with a sort of point that Michael was making about sort of the tyrannical, the sort of like tyranny of Trump and how it sort of like buys into this sort of like new like mass media culture we have. And I'm sure lots of you have been on social media recently and have seen that lots of people, after hearing Oprah speak recently, give a speech, a lot of people came out in support of Oprah for president. And there is a movement since Trump has got into office towards this idea of celebrity presidents. It's something I've had a debate in lectures, whether we're going to see more celebrity presidents and what celebrity presidents are. But we've had people like Oprah tipped to be the new president. Mark Zuckerberg says he wants to do it, and The Rock says he wants to do it. And this has been met with quite a lot of sort of elation. There's a lot of happiness. People do want to see Oprah. I saw Lady Gaga tweet that she wanted Oprah to be. It's interesting to see celebrities like this enter the political fray and then get other celebrities to endorse them. And however they are as a person, whatever their politics, it's quite easy to forget that these people are billionaires with significant influence. And it's a sort of it's a strange sort of return to kind of feudal politics. We've had this proper democracy. We've had the political alliance, like the Clintons and the Bushes, and everyone thought Jeb was potentially going to be the favorite before the election started for the Republican candidacy. But this hasn't happened. So you've got to look at Trump and see, has he made a significant change to the future of not just American political systems, but British and European and all political democracies around the world? So as a sort of next point, I wanted to talk about how bad has the president actually been, presidency rather, actually been. It's what Michael was talking about, that his influence in the administration has been diminished over time as some slightly more sensible, well, politically sensible, as we've judged them, characters have got into the administration, have sort of changed his policies to suit more traditional Republican ideas, low taxes, the stock market's booming, et cetera, et cetera. You can see him tweeting about it all the time. But as a student of IR, I find the foreign policy implications really interesting, particularly in terms of North Korea, and whether him by himself, Trump has sort of inflamed these this new era of tension with North Korea, or whether it was sort of an inevitable incident as North Korea gained the potential to launch nuclear missiles. With Kim Jong-il, it was never really a huge threat. They didn't have the capabilities. So although Bush had to address these sort of, various Bushes had to address these concerns from North Korea, it was never really at the forefront. But now Kim Jong-un has sent ballistic missiles that could reach mainland, could reach American soil. You have to wonder whether he himself has sort of inflamed these tensions. But we've got to look again, as Michael was saying, at his Twitter. And I'm sure you all probably saw, recently he tweeted, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just stated that the nuclear button is on his desk at all times. Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I too have a nuclear button, but is much bigger and more powerful than his, and my button works? See, this is quite hilarious. I follow quite a few different sort of international relations, sort of like satirical pages on Facebook, and it's not a far stretch to see that what we learn about in international relations quite often is about whether sort of the male body and this whole sort of like phallic metaphor come into it. And he just tweeted a very, very obviously phallic metaphor for his missiles being bigger and stronger than his counterparts, which again plays into his ego. So I sort of move on to the final bit, which is whether he is a stable genius. And I think it's unfair to completely write off some of his genius, whether you think it comes from his campaign team or himself directly. I think I was speaking to my housemate who's also on this panel earlier, he did win what many saw as an unwinnable election. Regardless of whether he wanted to win the election or not, his character, his politics, and his team, and his unfaltering devotion to not caring about scandal after scandal that would have downed pretty much any politician in living memory, for me. Clinton faced impeachment trials after stuff that doesn't even, it is in the shadow of the controversies and scandals that Trump has faced in his administration. The stability of said genius, I think, is the main thing that comes into question, as Fire and Fury mentions. Many people question his mental state. I watched a program on him, and during the 80s, sort of early 90s, when he was more sort of a property magnate, his interviews, he's actually a very coherent and literate person. He speaks quietly, he's quite concise, he has a broader vocabulary than saying bigly. I think it's very interesting to see what will come in the next few years, if he lasts the next few years, if the whole Russian scandal doesn't finally consume his administration, to see if it is potentially a deterioration of mental state, because I don't necessarily think in the 80s and 90s he had the tendencies and the speech problems he's had now, holding his water with two hands, clasping it sort of like a chalice and drinking water like that. I think there is a deterioration in mental state, and I'm not 100% sure whether he is stable, but I think to some extent his politics and his presidency so far has been genius, playing the media against themselves. This whole fake media phenomenon, I think he's done particularly amazingly considering the political situation in the United States.
So So I'm going to explain this from like a female perspective. However, I'm not going to say the female perspective because I can only speak for myself and my experience to try to understand this a whole lot more. So last weekend, we hear Trump say that he's not a feminist. Shocker. Like, we didn't know that. But however, because I don't really exactly subscribe to feminism myself, I ask myself, why are you annoyed? You're not even subscribing to that belief. The reason why I don't is because it doesn't really reflect the issues that I may be susceptible to face. As a black female, I'm susceptible to misogyny and racism. So put that together, it's misogynoir. So here's where our non-feminism differs. So mine is misogynoir and his is a desperate maintenance of his hyper-masculinity, which is really masculine fragility. Another difference is leadership and intent. He is a leader of a nation of 323 million. I am merely a leader of like two younger siblings. So with my responsibilities, just trying to relate this to my experience, is that I have to sort of look over their education, get like good friends, good relations, don't be a jerk to others, basically. But I cannot say I prefer my sister because she's female, such as myself, and because hashtag men are trash. I'm not going to do that. But this is simply what he does. As a leader, what one says holds large magnitude. His interest as a leader should span across all boards. However, he ignores needs of several demographics, which is reflected in his interests, such as the cessation of DACA, which helps child immigrants, Obamacare, the deportation of Muslims, insisting that there were fine people on both sides in their reaction to the Charlottesville riots. I understand free speech, but then could you really say that there were fine people in a group that believes in an obliteration of a whole set of people and call them good? And this is also reflected in him sort of like his self-centeredness in terms of branding other countries that are not such as his as shithole countries. I'm sorry, but my shithole country provides the call time for you to run your mobile phone to help you tweet those unnecessary tweets. So there is no surprise why you see women dedicating days, chunks of their hours protesting, as he doesn't really seem interested in our progress. Although I'm gonna have to give the man props. He's certain about what he wants. Compared to our Prime Minister, he has a clear personal brand. However, ideas centering his personal brand are linked to self-centeredness, which is clearly reflected in his first year in office. Thank you.
So I'm going to talk about the chapter within Fire and Fury that relates to the Russia scandal, which has sort of dominated the first year of Trump's presidency and really started to come into play just after the election, but just prior to his inauguration. And it's very interesting to have a look at how what we've heard from the other panelists about his mental state relates to how he managed to get himself involved in what could potentially become the largest constitutional crisis that America has faced for decades, going back a prolonged period of time. Now, the first thing to consider is who Trump is and what he respects. And Michael raised a really interesting point that Trump does not really have a set ideology. He's very much influenced by the last person that he spoke to. Now, there is a couple of notable exceptions to this, and one of them actually is his relationship and his view of Vladimir Putin, which has actually been reasonably consistent over the years. And within the book, Wolf has a look at why this might be. And I think the most persuasive analysis comes from another book, which is Trump Revealed, which is by the Washington Post, and looks back at Trump's early life. Now, Trump was sent off to a military academy when he was quite young, and he really enjoyed his time there. And from there, it was instilled in him a sort of lifelong respect for military men and people who had served, which is partly why Chief of Staff John Kelly has actually had considerably more success than somebody like Prince Priebus in controlling Trump. And Trump tends to respect strong men, and Vladimir Putin is no exception. He was part of the Russian Secret Service, and as we all know, does rather outlandish and ludicrous photo shoots portraying him as very much a masculine figure, which Trump enjoys because he knows how to deal with somebody like that, or he thinks that he does. So when you go into Trump's psychology, you can see quite easily why the groundwork for his troubles with Russia were laid, because he believes that when he's dealing with Putin, he's dealing with somebody in the same way that he might deal with a very high-profile business competitor, when you're negotiating a deal. And when you combine that with his sort of deep-rooted love of all things military, despite not serving because of some issues with his feet, you can see why he's been able to sort of conjure up this image. Now, in addition to this, it's not enough that he respected Vladimir Putin and broke from the traditional Russian line of the traditional Republican line of deep skepticism towards Russia. You have to look at his other failings, which are highlighted in the book and really come out in how he's gotten himself into this Russia scandal. And one of them is that he does not have the attention span required to properly vet the people that are close to him. And this has been his undoing and probably will be his undoing as Special Prosecutor Mueller continues his investigation. When you look at the people that Trump surrounded himself with, you can start to see how this investigation became so serious. So the investigation primarily began by focusing on a meeting between Sergei Kirilyuk, who was the Russian ambassador, and Michael Flynn, who had been appointed as the temporary national security advisor to Donald Trump. Michael Flynn lied about the contents of this meeting and whether it involved discussions over the Obama-era sanctions, which, interestingly, a new sanctions bill was killed by the Trump administration last night. Now, Michael Flynn took money off Kremlin-sponsored sources during the 2016 election campaign, which ought to have been enough for any reasonable president to end their association with this person, knowing that that is going to cause significant problems. He did not do that. The previous chair of his campaign, Paul Manafort, worked for Viktor Yanukovych, who was the Ukrainian president, who was backed by the Kremlin and deposed by revolution in 2014, took a huge amount of money from Kremlin-backed sources. Now, Trump does not have either the patience or the control to realize the existential threat that these issues pose to his administration. And what we've got ourselves into is a position where people around Trump are trying to protect him from this investigation, which is now extended to potential obstruction of justice. And we saw in recent days revelations that he potentially attempted to sack Robert Mueller as the special prosecutor, which is technically, he is allowed to do that, but would be a considerable break from tradition. And indeed, he fired James Comey, the head of the FBI, and recently probably forced out Andy McCabe, who was the deputy at the FBI. So in effect, what we've heard about recently about whether Trump is a stable genius, in many ways, his shortcomings have led and potentially will lead, if Mueller's investigation continues down the line that it seems to be going along, to his impeachment, because he simply doesn't have the personality traits required to do very, very basic things that you'd expect of a president and anybody attempting to become president. He doesn't seem to have the ability to recognize these very clear and obvious threats. And we spoke about the sort of the factions within Trump's administration. In many ways, the prominent role that Jared Kushner plays within the administration, who has no political experience and has his meetings with certain Russian figures, has poured fire on, poured fuel on Robert Mueller's investigation, just goes to show that he does not quite understand, and I still don't think he quite grasps, just how serious this investigation will be. And so when we talk about his mental state, obviously, when we look at it, it's in the more comical aspects of his tweets and his sort of bizarre appearances and speeches, it's sort of quite amusing. And we sort of think, well, how on earth did this happen? But from Trump's perspective himself, it could very well be his downfall.